This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the great actor and comic Steve Martin, the star of such films as The Jerk, All of Me, Roxanne, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Parenthood, L.A. Story, Father of the Bride, The Spanish Prisoner, Bowfinger, and Bringing Down the House. Steve Martin has also established himself as a novelist. He's just adapted his best-selling novel, Shop Girl, into a film. He's one of the producers, he wrote the screenplay, and stars in it. Claire Danes plays a young woman who's recently moved to L.A., where she's quite lonely. She works at Saks, at a counter selling elegant gloves for evening wear. And that's where she meets an older, wealthy, and elegant man, played by Steve Martin.
Who are you?
Good point. I'm Ray Porter. Hi, how are you? Look, I know you can't be seen chatting up customers, so why don't you just meet me Friday for dinner at 8 o'clock? You don't even have to give me your phone number. You can just show up. And if you don't, I'll just eat alone.
I spoke with Steve Martin in 2003. As an actor, particularly early in your career, your persona was usually very extroverted. As a writer, like your two novels are about really introverted characters. I just think it's an interesting contrast.
Well, I think actually that without, you know, being too boring, analyzing my sort of stage act, that character, he was a bit crazy. I was on stage. This, very similar to this character, really. It's like on stage I was really just expressing a perverse thought on the way the world worked. And I remember this one bit I did was, I was so mad at my mother. I used to scream it, of course, because she wanted to borrow $10 for some food. And, you know, there's some kind of link here between this character who just sees things in the odd way.
All writers talk about, you know, facing the blank page and so on, but it really is true that the difference between being an actor and being on the set and being, you know, working with other people is so different than staying at home and writing.
Right.
Do you like that more isolated process of writing?
Well, you know, they complement each other so well because, like you say, movies are active and social and physical, and writing is solitary and personal. And I never wanted to be an actor who sat home and waited for scripts to come through the door. I mean, it'd drive me insane, waiting and hoping. And so I always wrote and I always did comedy, and I just liked... I like the activity of it. You know, I just find that when I'm idle, which I always enjoy, I always find that something comes up, something pops up. So I'll get out the computer and start typing.
You know, I think it's hard when you're so accomplished at something to try something that you're new to, as you were new to writing novels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, when you're at the top of your profession in one thing and then you're brand new to something else, you can fail. You can be flawed, and you can be very insecure. You have no track record. So did starting to write bring out insecurities that you weren't used to because...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But there's a trick when you first start writing.
Teach it to me, please.
Well, you don't have to show it to anybody.
Right.
When you're sitting there alone and you haven't, you know, made a deal with somebody to deliver a book, mm-hmm. you're really on your own, and you can. It's like putting your toe in the water. You can have written something, and you give it to a friend, or you ask someone's opinion. So, it never has. You always fooled yourself because you know. And the reason I say you fool yourself, ultimately, you do want it to be out there, but you fool yourself by saying, "Doesn't matter. I can be lousy. No one will ever see it if it's lousy." And of course, they do see it, and sometimes it's lousy.
So you would agree that self-delusion is an important part of writing.
Very, very important. I really do. I think it is. It's like, I remember the first night I previewed my play, Picasso at the La Panagile. I'd never written a play. I'd written screenplays, but I was in Melbourne, Australia, and now it's 10 minutes before curtain, and all I could think is, what have I done? I didn't know if there's going to be a laugh, anything. It could have been so humiliating. But then only, you know, 40 people would have seen it, and I could have gone home with my tail between my legs. But I just like to add that I really don't have a tail.
Do you write many drafts before publishing?
What I do is I write without inhibiting myself, and then I will – a draft is not quite the right word in my head. I go through and I start editing, and I start reading it, and I start reading it over and over and over, which can get very tiresome. So sometimes I'll put it down for 3 months, come back, read it again, then I'll read it aloud to myself,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll read it to my dog. And I find that reading it aloud makes you catch every word. And to me, every word is important because I'm a reader who gets bored quickly. So I need to have these sentences on the move and be interesting all the time. So I try to catch everything.
Is your dog helpful when you're reading to him?
Well, he's my audience. I'm not looking for his response.
You just need somebody to read to.
Yeah.
Did you feel an obligation to be funny when you started writing? Because that's what people expect of you.
Well, no. Because the first book, Shop Girl, although it has funny moments, I wouldn't call it a funny book.
Right.
But in Pleasure of My Company, I actually wanted the book to be funny. And I knew that I had a character who could be funny. And whenever I start even a New Yorker essay, I have the idea, I think, okay, what is the potential of this? I have no idea what the individual bits will be or moments or anything, but does it seem rich or does it seem I'm going to run out of steam in a couple of paragraphs? And I felt with this character, he could really keep going. it's a cliche to talk about the discovery of character as you keep writing, but I found that my mind retains little details of things I've written 40 or 50 pages ago. And so something that you wrote that was very, very casual, a little aside, a little something he did, comes back at a certain moment and it becomes big. Because now this tiny little thing impacts something else, and it's like this, it's like weaving a web, or weaving a something else, a caftan. I don't know which I'm weaving, but that's what I really like, is where the details start to add up.
Well, you know, you've had your success in the book world and the film world, and you've been on the bestseller list, and you're probably the only person to have hosted both the Academy Awards and the National Book Awards.
I guess I am.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'll have to stop any Oscar host from hosting the National Book Awards. So I can keep my uniqueness.
So, I think that would probably give you a good seat as to some of the differences between the two worlds, the film world and the book world.
Well, the differences, the book world is much, much slower
mm-hmm.
than the film world. I mean, the film world is so oriented to promotion and getting the word out in certain ways, getting the word out in very vibrant ways and very specific soundbite ways. And for example, I mean, here I am talking to you for 40 minutes about my book. This would never happen about a film. I mean, in terms of the way a film is generally promoted, but it's the way books are promoted. They're talked about in depth in much slower ways.
Well, and the numbers are so much smaller too, aren't they?
Right.
Like a
right.
best-selling book probably doesn't come close to the ticket sales of a mediocre-selling movie.
Probably, yeah. But you know what I found is that when I started writing for The New Yorker, I noticed I got more reaction from one essay. And I'm talking about actual reaction that I could feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people saying things, than I did for movies, like entire movies that cost millions and millions of dollars to come out. And I would hear, you know, very little, or somebody would say, nice movie or something. But these essays, they started to, I guess it's because they're so intimate with the reader. They're so intimately involved that it stays with them longer. You know, a movie, sometimes I walk out, I've forgotten it, you know, as I'm exiting the lobby.
My guest is Steve Martin. The new movie Shop Girl is based on his best-selling novel. He wrote the screenplay and stars in it. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Martin. He stars with Claire Danes in the new movie Shop Girl. It's based on his best-selling novel of the same name. He wrote the screenplay. Well, I'd like to mention an essay of yours that I particularly liked, and it was a personal essay about your late father.
Yes.
And, you know, it was about how he had wanted to act and had done some amateur acting when he was young, and how you had, you know, kind of rocky relationship. And well, one of the things you talk about is how you decided to take your parents out to lunches every Sunday so that you could get to mm-hmm. know them better. Mm-hmm. And you realized mm-hmm. that they were bickering all the time when you took them out to lunch, so well, they weren't getting anywhere.
Right.
And then
they were contradicting each other, so I decided one time to take them out alone, each, you know, one at a time.
And that
and
worked.
Without the other person there, I could get stories and, anecdotes and opinions and attitudes that I never would have gotten if they'd been there together.
I thought that was so smart to think of that. And then you also wrote about how your father, when he was basically on his deathbed, said to you, mm-hmm. you did everything I wanted to do.
Right.
I thought, wow, that's what a zinger for.
Well, it's quite a moment, really.
Yeah. Did you ask yourself whether he would think it was okay to say that, you know, to write that? I guess one of the questions I'm asking is, do you think the standard does or should change when someone is no longer with us about what's too private to say about them? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I did not feel that was too personal.
Uh-huh.
I was very particular about what I said. In fact, I ran the essay by my sister to get her opinions on anything that might be too personal, but I didn't feel that was too personal because he was really demonstrating kindness there at that moment.
Because he'd been so critical comparatively in the
right.
past
mm-hmm.
of you.
Yeah.
Right. You haven't written a lot of personal stuff. Most of your writing is fiction or humor. And there's something that you wrote in an essay in the New York Times that really meant a lot to me. I mean, I wrote it down and stuck it on my computer so I could refer to it. I've mentioned it in a talk. And this was in the context of talking about why you decided to have a show of art from your art collection, something you used to be very, very private mm-hmm. about. And you said, being a celebrity can cause an accidental cheapening of the things one holds dear. A slip of the tongue in an interview, and it's easy for me to feel I've sold out some private part of my life in exchange for publicity. Mm-hmm. I really thought that was so well put, and I'm in the position, you know, of asking the questions usually, mm-hmm. and I know that that's always a possibility. Do you know what I mean? That both the interviewer and the interviewee risk cheapening things. At the same time, I don't want that to happen. That's like the unintentional mm-hmm. occasional result, but. You know, I think you're trying both ends to be really sensitive to that, but I thought you just put it so well.
Well, I think, you know, the problem with being interviewed as a celebrity is that, for example, you and I are talking now. We're talking on NPR, and it's a very special circumstance. It's much more detailed. It can be way more personal than, say, I would be on Entertainment Tonight. And I'm willing, much more willing to talk about private things in this circumstance. But what happens is this I might pay for 3 years from now in an in an interview on Entertainment Tonight, because they will bring up something, maybe something I said that's personal. Now, actually, that's kind of diminished because, you know, I'm at a nice stage of my career where, you know, I can get around. There's no sort of, you know, crazy invasion of privacy or, and I also learned to keep relationships to myself, because I realized that that kind of, I mean, I realized this a long time ago, that kind of focus on your personal life actually damages it.
You know, at the same time, I'm sure when you're doing an interview, even if you just see it as a promotional interview, you want to be as interesting as possible. So then, again, there's the kind of trade-off between, well, this will make it more interesting. On the other hand, it's personal. I just assume not talk about it. So does that equation play out in your mind?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, because there's almost no way for me to make an interview about a movie interesting. I've realized that. You know, I listened to Howard Stern, and he always plays celebrities' interviews, and we all just sound ridiculous. You know? And, you know, and I know that as I'm giving these interviews, I am that person that will be mocked, because there's just, you know, it's just not ultimately that interesting, you know? So you have to kind of make up things. And, you know, it's just a funny business. It's like the worst day of your life, you know, when you have to go talk about the movie you've made.
Oh, you're making me feel terrible.
Pardon me?
You make me feel terrible.
No, it's not you. I'm talking about the soundbite industry.
Uh-huh. Do you get obsessive about things where you really, once you get into it, you're into it?
Yes. But I think there's other terms for that.
Devoted.
Well, yeah. Well, I remember an article in the New York Times years ago called In the Zone. And it talked about when a basketball player is hot and he's just sinking these baskets one after another. And they talked about people who are in the zone losing consciousness of time. And we've probably all been stuck with a computer problem and you looked and suddenly 4 hours have gone by while you're trying to solve it. And that to me is what writing is. It just is so absorbing that time goes by. Time goes by quickly, or it stops.
Yeah, but the problem is with writing, if time goes by quickly and you don't like what you've written in that time, you feel like you've lost something. Maybe that doesn't happen to you.
Well, you know, I don't write unless I'm ready.
Uh-huh.
So usually I find if you're in the zone, you usually like what you've written. And if I'm not in the zone, I generally don't write.
Right.
I will edit at that point using what we'll call the monkey mind.
What do you mean?
Somebody gave that to me years ago. It was like the monkey mind was the you know, there was your creative mind and then there was your monkey mind. And your monkey mind was really consciousness. You know, and the monkey mind should do the editing. It's the one that's not original. It's the one that's imitative. And that's just a term for doing the slave work of writing.
Boy, the editor community is going to be very angry at that description.
No, I rely heavily on editors. I really need response.
Steve Martin stars in the new film Shop Girl, which is based on his best-selling novel of the same name. He wrote the screenplay. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Martin. He starred in many films, including the 1998 David Mamet movie, The Spanish Prisoner. Here's a scene from it. Martin plays Jimmy Dell, an apparently charming and wealthy man who befriends Joe Ross, played by Campbell Scott. Here, Jimmy is giving Joe business advice.
You know what the man said about verbal agreements? They're not worth the paper they're printed on.
That's what my boss just said to me.
Henry what? I mean, what is he talking about?
Well, I've got a, I have, thank you.
You're welcome.
I did something for the company, and they owe me something. I think I need to get it in writing.
I would. What do they owe you?
I think they owe me a lot of money.
What do you mean you think?
I invented something for them. It's a work for hire. They own it, but...
Hello, is Mrs. DeSilva in?
Who told you it was a work for hire? Well, they did.
You invented it?
Well,
I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a guy. Tell me, you invented it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Spanish Prisoner was written and directed by David Mamet.
Yes, absolutely.
Must have been a pleasure to to read his dialogue.
Fabulous. I love doing it. You know, his dialogue is a challenge for an actor because it's incredibly precise, including the ers and uhs and the way we speak, going back, retracing our words, just like I just did, or like I just did. And so it's really fun to do that because you really have to, you cannot, as you're speaking the dialogue, you can't get ahead of yourself. You have to actually forget at that moment what you're going to say next.
What do you mean that you have to forget it?
Well, in other words, if it's written that there's a hesitation or an and an ah, if you come up to it and you're prepared for it, it's going to sound like
mm-hmm.
It's going to be very dead. So you have to talk as though you know what you're going to say, but you don't. You have to forget what you're going to say at that moment.
And then you have to remember it again.
Yeah. Well, it's acting. I mean, you know what it is, you know.
So, do you feel like you learned any new things from working with Mamet?
Yeah, but it's you know, he was a really good director for me because he kept reminding me, you know, my character was supposed to be very wealthy and very confident. And he kept reminding me of what that is, which is nothing gets to you. No mm-hmm. one can get to you. And that was a great reminder. And it really provided me in the film with this kind of stillness and, ease with everything.
I sometimes think about what it must have been like for you and Ricky Jay, who was also in The Spanish Prisoner, to work together because you used to be... used to do magic, and Ricky Jay is, you know, one of the
right.
great
well, Ricky
living
Jay,
prestidigitators, is that?
Yes, yes.
And you know, master of card tricks and cons and the lore of magic and carnivals. And so
and I go way back. We go back to the late 60s.
Did you perform in the circuit together or something?
A bit, yeah. We actually met in Aspen, and he was working someplace, and I was working someplace, and... I remember he was a book collector and I was a book collector, and there's this beautiful, rare book called The Expert at the Card Table by S.W. Erdnes. And it was published, I think, in 1907, and it was one of the early books that exposed ways to cheat at cards. And, of course, the author, if he had been known, would have been beaten up. And S.W. Erdnes is Andrews, written backwards. And that was the real author. And we both sort of fought over a copy of that book once.
Who won?
I bought it, and then I gave it to him.
Oh, you're so generous.
Years later. Yeah.
Do you remember the point in your career when people started to realize, he's smart? You know, because you played kind of stupid, you know, wacky... personas, right? And then eventually people realize, God, he's really smart.
Well, you know, it's not something you can never say about yourself and believe it.
Right.
Is that you're smart? And so I don't, you know, I don't think of myself as smart. I don't know. I mean, I almost feel like if anybody thinks that, they're being cheated. Because I also know people who actually are really smart. And I've been around them. You know, what I am, if anything, I'm diligent. And but I've been around people who are smart, and I feel like my relationship to them is my dog's relationship to me.
Your dog's because, a good audience, let's not forget.
Yeah. Well, my dog, he gets, you know, if I say, go get the tennis ball, he knows to get the tennis ball. But if I say, go get the tennis ball and take it upstairs and put it under the bed, then he's at the point of duh. And I find that happening to me when I'm around really, really smart people, that there's a ceiling I hit of understanding.
And you're very funny on stage and on screen, as you are. People expect that you're just going to be, you know, a laugh riot when you speak in person, too. And did you have to deal with the expectation that you were just going to be, you know, a real cut-up in person?
Well, I guess a little bit, but sometimes I can be a cut-up, you know.
No, I realize that.
Yeah, and... you know, it's really people who don't know you who expect that, and I don't really find myself in those circumstances that much anymore. At least in private circumstances, I'm a pretty regular, sociable person,
mm-hmm.
Or a social person. So, I couldn't do in private what I did on stage. People would not want to be around me. You know, if I'm that hyper all the time. And, I've kind of worked it out now, kind of figured out how to be.
Listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Steve Martin stars in the new movie Shop Girl, which is adapted from his novel of the same name. He wrote the screenplay. Our interview was recorded in 2003. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. WHYY's executive producer of national programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Monkey.